Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
I'm Allison Kane, and welcome to In the Sauce, a podcast about building consumer brands from the ground up. I love doing this show because I get to interview everyone from production gurus to marketing and social media mavens, anyone who can guide me on this crazy journey. This is the story of building Haven's Kitchen sauces, but it's also the story of every growing brand because we're all in the sauce.
Today, I'm speaking with Ari Raz, CEO of The Coconut Cult, the small batch coconut-based yogurt company in those highly satisfying glass jars that delivers gut health and fun, innovative flavors like chocolate mousse, blueberry a la mode, and candy cookie. Ari is well known in the CPG world for co-founding Once Upon a Farm, the first cold-pressed refrigerated kids' food in a pouch. In late 2017, Ari shifted into president role when John Foraker joined the company as CEO. For the next 4 years, Ari oversaw the company's growth from $1 million through $50 million in annual sales. In 2021, Ari joined the Coconut Cult as CEO. And I'm so excited to have him here. Hi, Ari. Yay.
Hello. Hello. Hi, Allison.
Hello. Hello.
I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah. I mean, you know, sometimes they're incoming. In your case, I definitely slid into your DMs and I was like, hey, you want to come on my podcast? It's fun. You got to have both. But in this case, I think particularly because you've been on both sides of this like founder CEO thing.
Right.
And then we had a call and it was just really nice. I may or may not have, you know, cried. And then here you are now. So yay. How you doing?
I'm really good. I'm, you know, honestly, when I saw your DM, I was shocked and delighted and honored all at the same time. I don't know. I have this weird way of just never thinking I'm, you know, good enough for certain things and
for in the sauce.
To see your DM, yeah. For in the sauce. Well, you know, I interview some incredible people in this show. So to be invited, I really, you know, felt was a big honor. So I'm also not just happy to be here, but that call also was extremely memorable for me. And I just enjoyed talking to you so much. And yeah, just grateful to have the opportunity to be on this show, but also just to get to know you better as well.
Yeah, me too. And, you know, it goes back to these conversations tend to be so good and like helpful and, you know, I don't know, like soothing or something that it's great for me to just be able to share them with all the other, you know, people who are in it with us. So they can feel it too, you know, and hopefully get some good little nuggets out of what would otherwise be just a private conversation between, you know, two people trying to build things that didn't exist before. So it's December. And I think we're all kind of I talk about Miguel Leal a lot on the show, but he said something the other day because I was like, you know, it's like really slow until it's really fast. And he's like, yeah, like an avocado. And I was like, totally like an avocado. Like they're like not ripe, not ripe, not ripe. And then they're like you know, brown.
I love that.
And I feel like that's how the year has been almost. Like we've all sort of been like, what's going to happen? What's going to, and now it's like happening. Right. And I just kind of am curious about, you know, your thoughts. You know, I'm sure you've gotten calls from other founders, people running companies. The landscape is a little strange. I don't think we're heading into this like deep, dark, crazy thing that everyone thinks we are, but people are kind of behaving like we are. A lot of cuts, a lot of just trimming on the off chance. And also because we all know that cash is a little funny these days. I'm just kind of curious, you know, your big picture shower, 3 a.m. industry sort of thoughts, you know, what are you picking up on that's going on?
Yeah, that's a really timely question. So I see 2022 as being a year that went, I think, differently than a lot of people thought it was going to go back in 2021, right? You have, I mean, as far as I remember, you know, there was still this pandemic thing going on in 2021 mm-hmm. that we were mm-hmm. starting to see the light of. And everyone thought, oh man, once this thing is quote unquote over, it's just going to lead to this explosion of, you know, not just normality, but over normality and commerce, and things are just going to pick up like, you know, like right where we left them off back in early 2020. And I think that, you know, in a lot of ways, that sort of like explosion that we all thought was coming, it didn't happen the way that that we thought. And it, frankly, in some cases, right, happened. There's been this kind of weird slowdown in the market. We all of a sudden kind of realized, oh wait, but inflation and, you know, like supply chain issues are still ongoing, and, you know, just things that we thought were going to resolve themselves very quickly did not. And as a result of that, 2022 has been a pretty wonky year in terms of just meeting expectations. So, you know, I think for a lot of CPG brands and a lot of founders I speak with, I'm hearing two different kind of, I guess,
paths.
Perspectives. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, general thesis is, you know, caution, right? We have to be cautious. 2023 is definitely going to be this year where we're going to see the result of, you know, continued inflation, increase, you know, continued Fed interest rate hikes and things of that nature that are going to continue to put this damper on consumption,
spending,
spending, you know, premium CPG, etc. I'm hearing from some founders that are trying to fundraise right now about how challenging it is, and, you know, as somebody who I feel like I'm, you know, every other couple months I'm fundraising, it almost feels like, you know, I talk to investors as well. And, you know, especially the CPG investors, there seems to be this caution that, and this sort of reluctance. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It wasn't as prevalent a year ago. It was not as strong. And I think that it bears to reason that, you know, there's going to be a lot of results coming out of that, right? That reluctance to invest. And I think that we're starting to see it with some startups, you know, making announcements that they're no longer going to be in operation. But I suspect that will continue well into next year, where more and more startups are just going to either, you know, run up against a wall, not being able to raise any more capital to keep expanding. And on the other side, there's going to be those startups that, while being somewhat cautious, they're going to really
continue
take
to
advantage
innovate.
Of the trend, mm-hmm. Right? They're the ones that have gunpowder, the ones that are getting the support they need and are growing, I think have a really, really good opportunity right now to grab a lot of market shelf and build brand awareness.
It's interesting because I'm not an economist, nor do I have a business background other than like running my own. But I feel like what I'm hearing, even outside of like consumer, is that a lot of the resetting that bigger companies are doing, tech is doing, you know, they're just kind of going back to 2019 in a way. And this is really like a very rudimentary thesis, so knock it if I'm kind of reading it wrong, but it feels like in a way things, you know, did go back to normal. That the last couple of years weren't really normal, and that what happened was we all, you know, we started spending as if that was the new normal or that was the new growth rate. And, you know, so the tap of the, you know, the tap of the that was fueling that spending kind of turned off, but everything else kind of kept going, like every other cost that we have. And at the same time, then it's like, everyone stopped spending. Now you got to be profitable. And people are just kind of like, what? You know, and it's like, it's again, it's like the avocado, like they kind of knew, but now it just seems to be like confronting a lot of companies. And I think, you know, what everyone seems to say is that, you know, that's painful, but also, like you said, to some extent, a good opportunity for everyone to really look and take a deep look at what is working and what isn't, and what do we really need and what don't we? And, you know, there was this sort of, I don't know. I mean, we don't even know, you know, we went global with Whole Foods in April of 2020. We don't know what to benchmark against because we never had a pre-pandemic national Whole Foods brand. So, you know, I mean, I'm like a velocity freak. I think you probably know that at this point. Like, that's the thing I keep looking at, but I don't even know, you know, I know when it goes up, and but I don't know where it maxes out yet. I don't even know how to really even evaluate promos right now. You know, it's like a weird thing. And maybe we were just kind of like, you know, frogs in the water where we didn't even know that we were in this like different thing because we just adapted really quickly. And now we're just sort of stuck with some weird stuff that we got to muddle through, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think it's an interesting time to launch definitely nationally with Whole Foods. I mean, consumption patterns at that time and the way people would purchase.
Right.
You know, those things are shifting as well. Yeah. I think you're seeing it even in like DoorDash's latest announcement that, you know, they're letting go of tons of people. And I'm sure very, you know, all across the board, it, you know, home delivery of these groceries and things of that nature. It's just not, I'm sure it's still growing to some degree, but not nearly what we were seeing in the pandemic, right, where Amazon, you know, delivery and grocery delivery and Instacart and these things were yep, so important to, and central to any brand's, you know, marketing strategy at that time.
Yeah,
I think now it's shifting, right? It's okay, now we can actually engage with people again, and now we can
get back in the stores. You know,
get back in the stores. We can meet them on the street, right? Like you do, and just really leverage the fact that, you know, we can have real conversations face to face.
Yeah,
and use that to our advantage, right? That's really, I think, the important shift that a lot of brands need to come to terms with.
So going back to, you know, the the way that it was. I mean, it feels so crazy because 2017 was like not that long ago. And yet it feels literally like were there even electric vehicles back then? You know, like, I don't even know what was going on in 2017. I'm like, was the horse still the main form of transportation?
We had iPhones.
There
we
were trains. I think there wasn't TikTok. So in 2017, you made a shift. You founded this, you know, amazing, I love it because it's HPP product in a pouch. And it was very helpful to me because, you know, I'd be like, it's like Once Upon a Farm, but for grownups kind of, right? So it was like a nice little story. Like, but so you had launched Once Upon a Farm how many years before? Like, what year did you launch that?
So in 2015, I moved to San Diego to co-found Once Upon a Farm with Cassandra Curtis, who we both were baby food entrepreneurs prior to meeting with our own brands and decided to form, you know, come together and create a new brand using these HPP.
And it was going, I think from our conversation, I got the sense that it was going normally well, in the sense that you were growing, you were opening doors, you were creating a new category, you were, you know, doing what we do now, which is figuring out where does it go in the store, who's the right buyer, how do we tell this story, how do we prove out, you know, all of that stuff. And you were doing it. And it was going normally well. And then you got a celebrity and John Foraker involved. And then things went abnormally well. So how'd that happen?
John Foraker had always been a, not always, right? But for about a year and a half had been an investor and advisor to Once Upon a Farm. And he was one of our earliest investors. He was actually our first, you know, quote unquote CPG investor. For the brand. And, you know, we were so fortunate to get him involved at that early stage when we were doing our initial fundraising. And it was just good timing because he, when he was the CEO of Annie's, they had done some research on the category, and part of their research identified this white space to create a, you know, a refrigerated premium brand. And he's always had this in the back of his head as, wow, this would be something that some brand is really going to pick up the ball and run with. So when we showed him our deck and he saw the potential, he became an investor. So he had always been involved. Then Jennifer Garner got involved because of one of our advisors. So we worked with a gentleman named Greg Fleischman, who you may have heard of. He's also quite well known in our industry. At the time, he was co-founding a brand called Foodsters with Sarah Michelle Gellar.
Yep.
And her business manager, Nicole King, also represented Jen Garner, and Nicole was talking to Greg about Jen's desire to partner with a kids brand. She'd been looking for one to partner with for many years and really couldn't find one that...
Right, she wanted to get behind.
You know, she couldn't find an opportunity that really spoke to her, that she... Yeah. And part of her mission and purpose for doing so was she wanted to work with a brand that could really also in tandem support the work that she does with Save the Children.
Right.
It's, you know, a nonprofit. She's their official chief brand ambassador, and she speaks on their behalf. She's been working with them for, I think, the past 9 years and or even longer. And she is just a passionate advocate for the organization, for the work they do. And really, you know, a big focus of Save the Children is to go to areas that have been impacted by, you know, natural disasters and bring, you know, backpacks filled with food to schools for kids to pick up and things of that nature. And so when she heard about Once Upon a Farm through her business manager, she asked if she could try our product. So we got a phone call.
That must have been
Greg
fun.
Asking if we could mail Jen Garner some products. So we said, sure, why not? Like, I mean, you know how it is. You're working out of a garage or, you know, your first office, and you're just like, you know, dealing with like entering, you know, POs and setting up EDI. And you're just like, all of a sudden you get this phone call and you're like, okay, this is different.
Yeah.
So we sent Jen the products. She then asked if we could meet her. So Cassandra and I drove up to LA to meet Jen Garner in her manager's office. And in that meeting, it was really incredible. I mean, I didn't know what to expect. Neither, right. we didn't expect much, but we were shocked at how much Jen knew about us and the products and our story. Wow. And in the meeting, I had, not knowing what to do, how to prepare for something like this, and not being a very cool, like Hollywood guy. I just, you know, I brought my like pitch deck, but in the pitch deck, there was a little, you know, page with some advisors on it, and John Foraker's picture was there, and she saw that and she said, oh, I know this brand. And she then asked if we could arrange a meeting between her and John Foraker, because she wanted to learn more about the industry from, you know, someone who's run a really big brand for so long and done so much in the industry. So I reached out to John, and because he was a big Alias fan, he, you know, said, sure, I'll meet Jen Garner. So he flew to LA, and it was supposed to be like a 30-minute just like intro meeting, just to say hello and have a nice chat. It turned into this like 3-hour, I mean, almost like a love fest, where they didn't even talk about the industry or business. All they talked about was this, you know, greater mission that Jen's had forever to support kids through nutrition and through other means. And they, you know, vibed on such an incredible level of, you know, and in Jen, I think Jen saw in John this, you know, this guy who could make these kinds of big picture goals or reality. So she asked John, hey, John, you know, I really love this brand. I love what these guys are doing, but like, you know, I would love to work with you on this. I mean, if I was to join this company, would you jump in as well? And in that meeting, John said he would. So then it was, you know, up to Cassandra and I to decide what we wanted to do next. Ball was in our court. That's how they got involved.
Well, we touched briefly on this, but, you know, so for everyone, just FYI, I do have an episode with John from a couple years ago. He was the longtime leader of Annie's. Then he advised General Mills for a while, and he's been an advisor to a number of emerging brands, and, you know, just like one of those very singular people in this industry that has made a massive difference in the way that, you know,
I feel like if there was a Mount Rushmore, there was a Mount Rushmore of like natural CPG, his face
is carved on the left side. Yeah, for sure. and, you know, Annie's was like, Annie's changed a lot. And he's been at the forefront of, you know, pretty much every major certification that, you know, now is sort of table stakes, but wasn't for, you know, decades. So all that being said, is I'm sure that you were like, oh, wow, that's great. And on there must have also been a part of you that's like, oh, wow. So, you know, what about me? I mean, I would imagine, right? Is that?
Yes. Yeah, that's absolutely. And that feeling did not go away. It's not like I had the feeling and then I just was, you know, like I talked myself out of it or something.
Right.
That feeling stuck with me for about a year after I made this transition. It was hard, and it was hard for a long time. So what you have to understand is that, you know, we were only about really a year and a half into building this brand, a little bit more than that. So, sorry, about two and a half years right. into building this brand before we made this decision. And 2.5 years is not a very long time. The brand is still very much an infant at that stage. And my feeling was, I'm giving up the opportunity to accomplish the mission that I put on myself to accomplish,
right?
Which is, I'm going to be the one to lead this company into the light. I'm going to be the one to take this company to a place where it becomes a massive success. It's something that I want to feel like, you know, because I was the one going to every sales meeting, going into every investor pitch, leading all of these conversations, you know, whether it was, you know, just being the CEO face of the brand, right?
And
you put so much of you wrap so much of your own identity into this thing. And then, you know, only to then give it up and give it away to someone else. What are you left with, right? What are you after that? If you're no longer this thing that you're creating.
I think a lot of founders, you know, and this is why I'm so, you know, I don't know very many founders who've handed over reins to CEOs and also then become CEOs who've taken the reins from founders, which is why you are maybe, you know, on the far right of the Mount Rushmore, you know, CPG mountain carve. But I think, I mean, it is like, it is a question that I think those of us who are actually, thinking about it, ask ourselves a lot. And, you know, am I the right person to shepherd this company into this next phase of growth? Am I right for what's, you know, inevitably going to be a little bit of a dry season coming up? You know, there are, you know, in the hospitality world and people who listen to me, you know, talk regularly know that it's a very well-known, you know, you have an opening team for a restaurant, that opening team hands it over to the operating team. It's not the same skill set often to start something out of thin air and then to go operate it. And I think a lot of us kind of crave for someone, you know, to come in and be like, here's what you got to do. You know, let's look at ops. Let's look at sales. Let's look at this. Let's look at that. And a lot of us we don't have the liberty of bringing that person in. There isn't the right match or alignment for people who are generally good at that. I mean, one of the things that's amazing about this is that John was able to downshift almost all of his expertise into a company as young, because oftentimes people that come from those bigger CPG, bigger roles, they're looking around like, wait, where's the team? You know, where is everybody? So, you know, I have a friend who did something sort of similar, and she kind of walked in and she was like, you guys don't have Slack? And they were like, what? You know, and she was like, okay, I see, you know, and it just, she was like, where's, you know, do you have a CRM? And they're like, what? So what did he, what would you say he kind of got in there and he wrapped his arms around everything? And like, what do you feel like were like the basic things that he kind of did early on?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I mean, there were, before he came on, right? I was, you know, we were growing at a decent pace. And I think we were learning as we went. I mean, I didn't know what EDI was before I had to figure it out, right? Like, there's just things you kind of just figure it out as you go in a lot of cases. And you just sign the paperwork and you're like, okay, I did that. I guess it's all good now. So there were just a lot of that's kind of how I was growing and figuring things out and running the business, was just trial by fire. And I think that's the way a lot of, you know, first time entrepreneurs do it.
For sure.
But you know, there were days, right, more than one day, where I did have this wish, man, I wish I could just Mm-hmm. Have somebody like tell me what to do, like help me figure this out, because I don't know how to, you know, I don't know what else I need to do to get Whole Foods to open up more regions for us, or you know what I mean? Like, there's just these days where you're like, gosh, like, is there something that I'm not doing that other brands are doing that I need to be doing that I don't know I need to be doing because I'm not doing them or whatever? Like, and honestly, I can tell you that those feelings are, you know, and while they are very common, right, there is no one way. Yeah. And there's no quote unquote thing that you should be doing that other people aren't doing. Because
there's no secret room that you're not in.
There's no secret room. And every brand story, and it's different. There's no single playbook. I mean, there's general playbooks and there's guidelines that you can follow, but sometimes the recommendations in those books don't apply to your business and shouldn't apply to your business. What happened when John joined? So much changed. I mean, it was a full 180 on just almost everything.
Wow.
Well, you know, part of the reason for that, and it didn't happen immediately. You know, it took about 6 months. But part of the reason for that is because there was this necessity that it had to happen. You see, I was struggling with going from three regions of Whole Foods to, you know, six or whatever, like how, nine regions, whatever there's. I was struggling with that, right? That was my big goal was, can I get National Whole Foods? Well, National Whole Foods was approved the minute John joined the company. I mean, that was in the bag. Kroger National Distribution was in the bag. Target National Distribution was in the bag. Walmart Distribution was in the bag. I mean, it was, you know, Albertson Safeway, like so many accounts were just started to put us on their, on their lists for, you know, the next reset.
Right.
That it was mind blowing to me. I didn't believe how quickly.
So there is a room.
Well, there's a room, but you know, Jennifer Garner's in that room, right? It's like,
right.
And so it's, you know, what was unique about this case was it wasn't just John Foraker. Part of it was John Foraker, who obviously had these deep relationships with a lot of the retailers. But more importantly, it was the fact that Jen Garner was coming with us to all of these sales meetings. So like for the first 3 months, it was me and John and Jen and our sales VP and our marketing, the two marketing people that John brought in. And we flew to every single one of these retailer head offices, and Jen Garner's coming, right? So all the executives come in, the VP level folks come into the room. So now you're getting the big boardrooms at these major retailers, and you know, and they are just so excited at the prospect of building a brand with Jennifer Garner because they know how powerful her voice is. They know how she can get, you know, national PR opportunities and do all of these things that us normal citizens cannot. Right. So that was
I love
very
that you're
compelling.
Sharing that. I have to say, I really appreciate the, you know, I do want to talk a little bit later about the power of celebrity, because I think it's only gotten stronger since 2017, 2018, almost to the point where it's hard to do something without one, I would say. Let's take a little break because I'm over my 25-minute mark, and then we'll come back and we'll keep talking, but we're going to take a quick break.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
I'm back with Ari Raz, CEO of the Coconut Cult. So when we left for the break, we were talking about Jen Garner and the rooms opening up. I'm curious, before we get into, you know, your transition into being, you know, CEO at Coconut Cult, like, were you surprised at anything that John did, or that, you know, were there some sort of like, you know, you talked about how, you know, there are all these different, you know, there is no single playbook, but there are some guidelines. Do you feel like you learned a few of those guidelines when he took over as CEO?
Yes, 100%. So, I can run through a few things that John changed and tweaked and completely demolished.
Because I'm assuming you took those with you when you went into your next gig, maybe adapted them for the right culture and the right product and the right team, but they informed the way that you then became CEO.
Yes. So there were a few, so there's a few things. First of all, HR and people. I thought we had pretty decent benefits as a business, and I thought we were doing a pretty good job at treating our people well and all this. But it wasn't what we had in place wasn't good enough for John. What he wanted us to put into place for the employees, for the team, was I was using Gusto, you know, very very common for entrepreneurs to use. He said, we need to get a PEO. We need to get, you know, we need to get the health insurance that blue chip companies offer to their employees. We need to have better, we need to have stronger HR policies. We need to have, you know, just more structure around how we treat employees. And we need written guidelines, right? I was kind of just hiring people and asking them what they wanted and making sure that they were taken care of.
And being nice. Yeah.
And being nice, but like he wanted like policies and things in place that, you know, we had a very meager employee handbook, but he wanted something that was robust and well thought through. And I really appreciated that because, you know, things like putting an official bonus program in place, actually like writing down a policy on how the company distributes equity to employees and like having that solidified in place. Like, these were things that were always kind of in my head, like, yeah, we'll get to that or we'll do that. But he made it a priority from day one to make sure that we had policies to really reward the hard work of our employees. And also, I think, to be able to hire and attract top talent
into
our company. So that was something that I didn't place enough emphasis on as a CEO that I realized, okay, this is HR, super important. I gotta make sure that I'm always thinking through that piece. And then he also made sure that he actually led the charge to rewrite our vision and mission statements and really went through a process, because for him, making sure that you can articulate your values, not just amongst the leadership team, but then have that carried down to every single employee in the company and really build that vision together, is something that I've always thought it was important to have a vision statement and a mission statement. But the way that he used that to communicate to the rest
everything
of the company
else.
and have everything else flow through that was different. And it was awesome to see how important that was to him. And I didn't appreciate it as much prior. The other pieces are, you know, knowing your numbers, right? So There were aspects to our financial reporting that were never accurate. They were always murky. Trade spend is definitely a big one, but also inventory. Inventory was always so hard to pinpoint and articulate on a balance sheet because we didn't have, all we were using at the time was spreadsheets and QuickBooks. Mm-hmm. We didn't have a robust ERP system, right? So that was one of his first big priorities, was to implement a robust ERP system so that we could know fully, you know, exactly what our inventory was, where inventory was by warehouse, by lot code. Right. And then of course, raw material inventory as well. So that was something that so when he joined, he basically brought in a leadership team, right? Which we didn't really have before. So he brought us a chief operating officer, a vice president of sales, a VP of brand marketing, a VP of marketing communications, and then a small team under each of these folks to support them. And by doing that, by building that structure, it really showed me just how important, what the importance of having a leadership team, what the importance of having a leadership team really means. Because yep. before I was kind of managing it with my co-founder, mm-hmm. and we were in charge and everybody was kind of under us, right? Yes. It wasn't like there was this brain trust of people with different backgrounds and specializations that, you know, would fill in all these different gaps.
Right.
But John built that from the very beginning. And I see that in every single decision that he made, how vital the input that he would get from his team, from this brain trust of seasoned leaders, really helped him, right, make the most clear, well thought through decisions he could for the, you know, future growth of the brand. Obviously, it's not something everyone can do.
No, but I think just knowing what those functions are a little bit, knowing that, you know, and it's interesting because, you know, I have another friend who, you know, they're in like the 20 million sales range, which is, mm-hmm. you know, bigger than us. And mm-hmm. she's like, we're just getting to the point where I feel like we can attract, you know, real, you know, rock stars. And I'm like, really? Like, we have to wait that, you know, I feel like the people that, you know, are coming to us are real rock stars. But, you know, obviously you just continue to, it's not even about, you know, ability. It's about experience at some point. And, you know, there's just, you start to, I think you just start to, I mean, Anouk was saying this on her episode a week or two ago, you know, there's just, I think there's a, it's like the avocado, right? We, as founders, we know enough to know, hopefully, that we are probably not the best people to decide a couple of things, because we know that we are not going to have all of the information. And ideally, what happens is you bring in people who are able not only to put these decisions in ways that, you know, you can sort of, you know, evaluate them, but also that have seen what the possible tentacles of those decisions can be later on. And that's where I think young companies, you know, I'll give you a great example. We ship directly to Sprouts. And the reason why I did that was because it was, you know, we were launching with Sprouts when we were in like UNFI vortex of hell. And like last, you know, October or whatever, when like nothing was getting picked up and everything just felt like we were getting paid to pick up, but we were delivering. So it was like just a total nightmare. And so I was like, I just want out of Distributorville. So we're just going to go direct. And had I had someone, you know, on the team with me who had an experience of what that would then mean for those Sprouts warehouses that only have 8 stores, right? But you still got to get there. Maybe wouldn't have made that decision. So now it's like there's time that goes into undoing the stuff that you do, and you do it with the best of your ability and everyone means very well, but you just don't have the foresight, I guess, because you've never done it before. One question I have for you is, you said that, you know, he brought in COO, VP sales, VP brand marketing, and VP marketing comms. And I'm just kind of curious how brand marketing and marketing comms, like, where's the border?
Right. I asked myself the very same question when he did that.
Good.
There were if you ask me what I learned from John, a couple of things I learned. I mean, I didn't know. I was like, what's a trade marketing manager? I don't understand the purpose of this position. Right. And, he knows, like, he understands how these different functions fit into the equation to make a greater whole in such a way that I didn't see the need for it. I didn't understand. Now, a brand. So the difference between the brand marketer and the marketing communications person, they're very different skill sets. The marketing communications person is really, it's almost like an internal PR person in a way. Right. They're managing all of your communications, your social, your emails, your even something like direct to consumer, that team would fall under Marcom. Anything that's very communications out, messaging outward. The person that he brought in also obviously was tasked with working with Jen's PR team to manage her appearances and then speaking opportunities and all this.
Right.
So there's a lot, and that was a very important position for the time when we were first launching with Jen, to really establish the brand as, you know, being co-founded by Jen and really like giving her a strong presence as a voice within the company. So it was very vital that he brought somebody on to help manage that. And then the brand marketer is really focused on, they're far more analytical. So they're running the consumer surveys, they're working on innovation, they're running things like not rebranding, but they're making, you know, changes to the branding or the messaging. They're constantly looking at data. The trade marketing manager rolls up under the brand marketing side. They're also looking at promotional pricing and general ARP strategy in the broader market.
Got it.
They're also, you know, run. So there's just like a lot of pieces there that fall under that side. And they are two different, if you really think about it, right? Having one person manage both, it makes less sense because they are two very different skill sets. But both fall within the realm of marketing. Yeah.
So then, 4 years later, someone slides into your DMs and there's a theme here, and, you know, you go and basically, I don't know where Coconut Cult was when you stepped in. I imagine that they didn't have the capacity, to build out what you saw built out at Once Upon a Farm.
No.
But, and my guess is that the way that you handled your, you know, watching the kids in the pool kind of transition was very informed by the way that you felt as a founder having that happen as well. So I'm curious about some of the things that you did in your first 6 months when you stepped in as CEO.
Yeah. So basically what happened is that I started advising this company before I left Once Upon a Farm, and you know, just from a distance, really loving the brand, thinking they had a phenomenal product, but also seeing them making a lot of mistakes and doing things that typical founder things that I just felt like were not the right things to do for the development of the, like the stage of development that the company was in.
Yep.
And I had to, so when they asked if I'd be interested in joining as CEO, I said, I would be interested, but I need to know certain things from you guys. I need to know, you know, exactly what it is that I'll be able to change. Right.
Right.
And I also need to know that you've got my back and that we're aligned on a lot of this. So it was honestly, it was not easy to come into a company that had three founders who were so tied into the brand and what it was doing and start to make, you know, all the changes that I wanted to make. It was incredibly difficult. And it took a lot longer in some cases to make changes than I had originally planned. Now, that being said, like I said, every company is different. Every playbook is different. What I started to come to appreciate, and it took me time even to get there myself, was that the things that I was getting pushback on from the founders were things that in some cases were actually incredibly valuable pieces of the company that if I hadn't gotten the pushback, you know, I would have overlooked.
Right.
So an example of
but
something
it's good that,
that
you had that trust there, right? Because I think, you know, yeah. I do this with Courtney and Keely on my team all the time. I love when we have, they're my safest relationships I've ever had in my life, honestly, because there's so much trust there that they know that when they push back, I'm really listening. And when I'm probing and asking like, but why, they don't need to get defensive. I still really trust them. They still really trust me. Those are the best decisions because they come from this like kind of alchemy of, well, this doesn't make sense from, it's like what we were talking about earlier. Like, it's just, there's what happens when you get really, really engaged people who understand sort of different pieces of the business in like a bucket together, you know, slopping it around, you end up getting, I don't know why I keep using, I'm like frogs and mountains and I don't know, avocados and buckets. I'm like very, I don't know what's going on, but you know what I mean? So I think it's great because clearly you established that trust with them. So, and you trusted them, right?
Yeah. So a couple things they let me do right off the bat. So within like the first 60 days, the first thing, and this was a really, really difficult thing for me to get the founder to agree with, was he started this path for the company to make a gelato of an ice cream, which was delicious, and it sold very well in Whole Foods Sopac and Erewhon, and it was a phenomenal product. The problem with it was they built a yogurt factory, and they took so much time and emphasis off their yogurt to focus on building this ice cream business.
Yep.
And it really, you could see how it really just caused the yogurt business to shrink.
Yep.
And it stalled the momentum of the brand in a massive way. And I really had to go in there. I moved up to San Luis Obispo where the factory is for the company. And I rolled up my sleeves and I spent, you know, the first 40 days there, going over every single thing that was happening and taking place in that factory from, you know, who's communicating with who, why are they communicating? Who's doing the purchasing? How are they doing the purchasing?
Right.
Who's in charge of making the product? How are they making the product? And every single piece of this business. And, I made a couple big determinations. And one of them was the ice cream business has got to go. We have to stop making this ice cream because it's taking time off of not just production, but it's taking attention away from the broader team to focus on growing, you know, one business rather than trying to develop two businesses.
I think we've talked about this too. And maybe this is going to settle down now with like the new normal, but there has been, I think, a pressure on founders to like platform out a little earlier than necessary, you know, like,
oh yeah,
it takes a long time to build brand trust and loyalty and customer and consumer trust and loyalty in one product, in one category, to be really young and be in different parts of the store and in different channels and different distribution systems. And like,
it's too much. And I didn't, you know, and investors, I mean, there were investors on, you know, who had been with the company.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. On both sides. And I was surprised. I was like, you guys should be cheering this move because, you know, this is still a very small business. We haven't cracked the code on how to grow a sustainable leader in plant-based yogurt yet, but that's our goal. That's our mission. We have the potential to be that. So why would we want to be anything else right now?
Right. So that was like the primary thing. I mean, and then going back to, you know, I think you and I've talked about this too. Like, I think one of the reasons I love this show and one of the reasons I love talking to other companies is like, it's just really fun watching businesses figure out what their path up the mountain is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know. I picture everyone like in their own little cart going up the hill, and no one's cart is exactly the same. And they're not even like competing for spots most of the time. They're just in their own little thing. And I think what's fun watching you guys do is like, okay, you know that you self-produce, which is pretty awesome. You do have this sort of like culty kind of like people are obsessed with it type of brand. So it seems like you found this like amazing path up your hill, which is these limited editions with celebrities and influencers that are quite culty in and of themselves. And you can get them out really quickly and you can make them feel very personal to these people. So it's like everyone's like a mini co-founder almost of a one edition SKU, but, and then they have all that buy-in. Like, did you see that or did you fall upon that? Is that a good way to characterize?
Like, yeah.
What? Yeah.
I'll make a long story as short as possible.
Mm-hmm.
The company had been doing limited edition flavor launches before I joined the business. They had been doing this for a while. And there were certain things that we stopped making ice cream. There were so many fundamental shifts that had to happen in this business. And that would be a book's worth of things, but
I'll buy
we,
it.
One of the things we did was we made a decision collectively as an LT to launch a limited edition yogurt flavor every 2 weeks, beginning August 22nd, and we have a very small team that manages the relationships in terms of, okay, are we going to partner with a brand or are we going to partner with an influencer? We have a small team that does the R&D in our factory and creates the flavors. You know, overall, I'd say that it was, you know, given the size of our team to say we would do this every 2 weeks, it was a bit...
ambitious?
A bit ambitious, but we did it. No, we did it. We did it through.
Wow.
We did it through the end of November.
And where do you, you sell those all online? And
we sell them all online. And
right.
But,
okay.
But part of it was also to develop these relationships and to build the buzz and all this. So every time we'd release a limited edition flavor, we'd also mail out the limited edition flavor to quite a few influencers. Honestly, a lot of these influencers already know about the brand, already love it.
Right.
I mean, at the end of the day, we make a very, if you are very, very focused on your health and you want to eat foods that are really going to benefit your digestion, the Coconut Cult is, you know, the best option in the yogurt set for you.
Right.
So a lot of the folks who know this, right, they're long-term loyalists to the brand, yep. which we love. So we send them free yogurt. It happens to be a limited edition flavor that gets them more excited. Without asking them to post about it, they generally will post.
Right.
That then creates a wave of awareness. And what we did also on August 22nd is we launched our TikTok account. So we started to reach out to TikTok influencers as well, which created this whole other wave of awareness that we hadn't experienced before. And honestly, what happened over the course of September, October, and November was so impactful to our overall business.
Right.
In terms of growing it, bringing in literally, I mean, I'm not kidding, 300,000 individual visits to our website between September and October, 300,000 individual users visiting our website, and 20% of those people go straight to our store locator.
Yeah.
You can imagine what it's done for us
right.
in terms of sales. So it's been this incredible, very rapid transformation of the business from a place of, you know, trying to grow me doing everything that I can to really prime the pump to get things going, to now we're so overburdened with demand and purchase orders stacking up that we are way more focused on capacity and supply chain increases.
Right.
So that's
the avocado again.
There's always something. Yeah, there's always something. But you know, it's definitely a better place to be, and it's a better problem to have than
for sure. And I mean, I think if you are in charge of your own production, and you know, we take our validation process is a 9-month HPP validation, as you know from your days in HPP. So we're not on that same timeline. But I think it's a great, you know, obviously. I think Ouroboros does something sort of similar in the way that they have, and Jing does too. You know, they're these limited editions. Sometimes they're with people, sometimes they're just like funky flavors, or there are things that, you know, people are demanding. They use that as a, you know, way to get a lot of brand awareness and engagement. And then that translates into larger retailers saying, you know, we just want to touch this brand. And you don't necessarily need to give them, you know, you can give them vanilla, but they're just happy because they're in the cult, you know, they get to be a part of the cult. Okay. Last question. So Armin doesn't get frustrated. Every CEO, every founder, everyone leading a CPG company, we've talked about, you know, looking at stuff and sort of the challenges, but what's something that you are doing right now in the month of December that you would like every one of us to be thinking about or doing?
I am raising more money than I need to raise.
Yeah.
For my plan.
Yep. Great. That's it. I mean, it's funny because I'm always like, I'll do this note and then I'll take a break and then I'm like, just stop with the breaks. Like, you're not taking a break. You're just not.
Yeah.
So stop telling yourself you're going to, because you're just going to set yourself up for me. Like, you know, you got to keep going.
Exactly.
Ari, this was so fun. Thank you so much. I knew that I was going to love this conversation, and you did not let me down. So I appreciate you coming on, and I hope, you know that you are not only worth it, but like any podcast would be lucky to have you as a guest.
Wow. Well, thank you so much, Allison. I'm so thankful for the time. Thank you for listening to everybody who's listening. It was a lovely conversation. You're a wonderful human being. I'm so thankful you're in our industry.
Aww,
we owe you a deep debt of gratitude because you've really, by doing this podcast, you've put out so much positivity and good information and helpful information to so many. So thank you
for all this great work. Thank you. And Armin, I would not be able to put out all of this great information if not for you. So thank you to our engineer, Armin, and thank you to Heritage Radio Network. And obviously, if no one listened to it, you guys all know I would still do it just to get to talk to people like Ari, but I am really glad that you are listening. So thank you for listening, and I'll be back next week with another episode of In the Sauce. In the Sauce is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.